Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for what we call the weekly update here on Fridays at JM in the AM. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Your thoughts as we now enter a transition stage and Bill de Blasio will be the next mayor of the city of New York?
Well, I think all changes can bring exciting possibilities, and we'll have to see who is in the government, how quickly he moves, and he seems to be moving very quickly to implement some of the things that he has said he sees as his priorities. I think it's very exciting that Chaim Deutsch will be sitting in the city council. For the first time, you have two traditional Jews sitting there who will be advocating both for their total constituencies, but also be sensitive to the special needs of the community. I think that other people won who will serve the city and the community well.
It's amazing how many people now collectively are serving in the New York State Legislature with traditional ties or who are active traditional Jews in our community. And now, as you just mentioned, the city council as well. It begs the question, Malcolm, and I'm sure people are thinking about this every time we get to Election Day, and I sort of call it the D'Amato-Schumer doctoral thesis, if somebody would write it, and that is it in fact better for our community to have high-profile people from our community in seats of government like you just described, or is it sometimes better to be a little bit more off the radar and allow our friends to fight for us in those respective government bodies?
I think it's good to have people on both sides. I think we have enough good people, committed people, both to serve, which means great sacrifice, and we should appreciate that. And at the same time, people who advocate and support them, we need people to be involved to do voter registration. And the lesson of this election, and especially Chaim Deutsch's election, is that when a community gets involved, you can look at the numbers and you look at the odds and be discouraged and say it can't be done, and it could be done. And I credit the Flatbush Jewish Community Council, the rabbis, the activists, the people who got really behind this campaign, and Chaim, of course, himself. And the need now to sustain the outreach to all parts of the community, both on the part of the candidate and the part of the organization, so that they are representative of truly the broadest constituencies, and most of all, that we educate our young people to go out, vote, get involved. We still have very small numbers. When you looked at this election, was decided by 2,000 votes or so. You realize how much each vote counts.
And back to my point just for a second. So therefore, you would not discourage someone with a yarmulke, for instance, vying for a government body position, but you would hope that no matter who it is, they would behave properly and represent the community properly.
That is a given. And I think that the integrity of the person is the critical factor, regardless of whether they wear a yarmulke or not. That's the first thing that one wants from elected official. Although there's a Gemara that said you shouldn't elect anybody who doesn't have a skeleton in the closet, because if they become too haughty, you can always remind them.
Mm.
But I don't think there's anybody who...
that was in the pre-Twitter Talmudic times.
Yeah, that was with the Karl Rove of Talmud said that. So I think the message is important, that also people get elected have to always keep in mind, or those involved in political life, you always have to, you know, maintain a degree of humility and realize that you're a servant to the people, you're there and privileged to be there, to be able to do this, not to lose sight of it. And when they do, they get into trouble. And we saw in this past year how many people embarrassed themselves, embarrassed their communities, embarrassed others by their behavior.
Yeah, no question about it. And we have so much to discuss and so many important things, but just for a moment, in terms of what happened here in the Garden State, Malcolm Honlein has expressed his frustration with how long presidential campaigns are. I think you're willing to agree at this point that essentially they're at least 2 years in advance of a presidential election in this country. After what happened here in New Jersey, you do realize that essentially we're now in a 3-year campaign for president, right?
And what about Chuck Schumer's endorsement of Hillary?
Right.
Already.
Good point.
So we are well into the presidential election. I think it's devastatingly harmful, not what Chuck did, but in general, to have such long campaigns. I think people lose interest. and people get knocked out who might be the best candidates, but because of the length of time, you know, they like him, then they dislike him, and whoever's the front runner, I mean, everybody will be running against themselves because nobody will want to be a front runner to get knocked off anymore.
Right.
You
know?
It's going to be until the end. Look at all the people who were front runners during this mayoral campaign.
Right.
Quinn was so far ahead. Right. Wiener was far ahead. Thompson.
Right. Everybody had their time where they
Blasio was always behind.
And frankly, even Wiener enjoyed first place for a while.
For a long time.
Right. Well, if what you just said, again, you know, from an analysis standpoint, is the way to go, then the governor of New Jersey really has got to start to lay low over the next few months. In other words, you know, this big bump or burst in popularity, and I hear he's going to be on every Sunday talk show, you know, around the country, which is understandable, that could last for a few days. But if it lasts too long, like you just said, the inevitable is going to happen, and, you know, that merry-go-round of candidates is going to knock him right off.
I'm not sure he's capable of laying low, but he's very entertaining, and he's sharp tongue and makes for good interviews. But I think he himself will realize that that's not something that sustains, and that got to moderate how much. Right now, he should take advantage of the opportunity, you know, to get the nationwide exposure.
And we know that he enjoyed his trip to Israel, so that's good.
Was good.
All right, there's so much going on, so much to talk about in terms of what's going on in this world of ours. Let's start with the there's a statement by John Kerry. Now, John Kerry, and I read that as opposed to how Hillary approached negotiations between Israelis and the PA, he's really involved. I think it's become obvious, but he's really been involved. United States Secretary of State John Kerry, according to the Jerusalem Post, painted a very bleak picture of what would be the result of a breakdown in the current Israeli PA talks, warning on Thursday of a third intifada and international isolation of Israel. Now, Malcolm, I know that Kerry has a responsibility to try to get these two parties to the table and hopefully, from his perspective, get to a peace process and peace agreement as soon as possible. But isn't it rather bizarre or inappropriate for the Secretary of State to sort of give a pass to the PA that if in fact these negotiations break down, an intifada or isolation of Israel would be justified?
I think it's unfortunate when they publicly raise these things, because you are, in fact, to a degree, not only legitimizing it, but putting the onus on one party. I think the involvement of the Secretary is sometimes helpful, sometimes to be a bridge. There have been bridging proposals, which Palestinians didn't like, which Israel did like, some that Israel found unacceptable, which Palestinians, I'm sure, would find acceptable. The talks themselves have now been going on for 3-4 months or longer. The United States, by the way, this week gave the Palestinians $75 million more. The Palestinians say they want the EU and the UN and Russia into the talks. And I think in this regard, they are trying to put more pressure on the United States. They do press and threaten an intifada. This is a lethal threat, obviously, remembering what happened the last time.
Yeah. So
there's a lot of debate in the security services in Israel whether that's actually a feasible threat or not, whether it's likely to have much of an impact. And, you know, the United States comments come after this devastating release, leak of information about, well, it wasn't devastating, but embarrassing leak of information regarding Israel being responsible for the attack in Syria,
right,
which, you know, neither side made any public mention of, because Syria, if it makes the accusation, and Israel, if it takes credit for it, then requires a response. It forces Syria to respond. This way, when you leave it ambiguous, there isn't the pressure to say, they say, well, we don't know who carried it out. The United States did it because they didn't want to be held responsible, and they think felt that it might undermine the relationships at the non-existent Geneva talks. And it undermines the confidence in the relationship, and I think does a lot of damage when you then go to the prime minister and the United States has the presence of an ongoing representative who does not sit in the talks but goes in at the end and then gets an update which he communicates back. So the talks are clearly at a critical stage. You know, we've seen the discussions about the Jordan Valley, Israel's building a fence there, the announcements of new housing. By the way, it's not construction. It's the zoning process, which means that it takes a long time till it comes to fruition. I think that the way to get to a deal is not this way. And frankly, I still do not believe that Abbas will sign a deal. I don't believe he wants a deal. I think he wants negotiations. The other thing that will complicate it is these revelation about Arafat, the study of Arafat's remains that indicate he did have plutonium poisoning, and a very high degree of it was found, very unusual degree, obviously, a multiple of what is in any regular human being's remains. And, of course, this opens the way to accusations that Israel did it. It's interesting that Mrs. Arafat, in her comments, did not point the finger at Israel, and obviously there are a lot of candidates possible. Israel is the least likely, because if Israel wanted to eliminate him, they could have many times.
Yeah. I got a review for a second. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program. Heard and listened to, sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, Rockland County at 91.9 on the FM dial, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Malcolm Honlein is with us. I'm actually trying to find a statement that I had regarding the revelation about the Syrian attack and the United States really stabbing Netanyahu in the back on that one. I can't find it a second, but let's review what you just covered. So we're trying to, the United States is trying to continue to establish some type of agreement and move forward between the PA and Israel. At the same time, they do what has happened to other countries as well over the last few months, which is demonstrate that they don't have their allies back. Because, as you just described it, the United States, because of what was in their better interest, went ahead and revealed that Israel was responsible for that attack on Syria. And do we know if there are there must be repercussions for Israel when that's revealed, right?
There are potentially serious repercussions. We haven't seen it yet. I mean, it's interesting that you don't see a response, nor did you see a response to the earlier attacks, which were attributed to Israel against Syrian targets,
right,
which are not actually directed at Syrian armed forces. They are targeting the material that is supposedly on its way to be transferred to Hezbollah, or has been transferred to Hezbollah, and Hezbollah is going to transfer it to Lebanon. And both sites contain these rockets supplied by Russia, sold by Russia to Syria, and Israel acted preemptively to prevent a terrorist organization from acquiring these more advanced weapons.
Right. Then you mentioned the potential for an intifada, as Kerry didn't allude to, but said it directly. So what does it mean when you say that Israel security services don't see how it's possible? That means what's missing that allowed for intifadas years ago but would not be able to put it into action now?
I didn't say it's impossible. I was talking about the likelihood.
Right.
And there are people who argue both sides. And the threat of an intifada from Arafat's remains, the discoveries from Arafat's remains, and the constant incitement, by the way, by the Palestinian Authority in many ways, but especially about construction on Al-Quds, meaning on Har Bayit, on the Temple Mount.
Right, but there's always a motive. I mean, the motive's never the issue. The question is, when the motive is taken advantage of, why wouldn't they have the wherewithal, the equipment, the camaraderie, the strategy to carry out an intifada?
So I'm coming to that. And you've seen concomitant with these things the rising number of violent attacks, especially in Yehudun Shomron in the West Bank, where people have been killed or stabbed or attacked. There's a debate whether this is coordinated or they're individual incidents. I don't think that the difference lies in terms of what it means then for an intifada. What it does indicate is this rising tension, this rising activism. We know that Al-Qaeda, other groups are there, and Hamas are instigating, and the PA itself is responsible for a lot of it, including Abbas and all the leadership who continue to engage in this incitement. So you have the conditions for it. That's the point of this. Second part is whether there is the motivation right now in the organization, and people are still working and people are still receiving aid and stuff. So that is one of the things that they don't want to risk. They don't want to go back to the 2 or 3 years of the intifada the last intifada, which was costly for them. It was very costly in Israeli lives.
Right.
But it's also for them. It disrupts their lives. They have no jobs. They have no, you know, money coming in. Their lives come to a standstill as well. But instigated to the point where it breaks out, then you have people start to join in, and all those who want to take advantage of it or those who want to exploit it against the PA, against Israel, or for a variety of other reasons.
So the rhetoric is always there. You just need the desire of the people in order to carry it out.
And anything could ignite it. And it can start small and then either simmer or explode, you know, with all the frustrations and people knowing the corruption of the PA. They want to get rid of Abbas. So you people who have another agenda, not related to this, but related to the PA itself and its leadership, could exploit these circumstances. And all this competition for leadership will provide opportunities for people to be more and more extreme, because that's what they believe wins favor in the streets.
And then finally, on the Arafat thing, so, I mean, I understand it as, you know, as being part of the what could ignite an intifada and all that. But, I mean, what's going on here is obvious, you know, and we know this from Jewish history, that, you know, people try to establish some type of lie or reputation, and then it lasts, you know, sometimes for thousands of years. So essentially what they're trying to do is rewrite the history books to make sure that people generations from now associate Arafat's death with an Israeli assassination, a successful Israeli assassination attempt, right, essentially.
That's right. You rewrite history, but you also rewrite it for the contemporary times. You know, there was a study that showed that less than a third of Palestinians said they would participate in a new intifada, and more than half support the negotiations. About 40-some percent said they didn't, and but most are not optimistic. So the fact is that it indicates you used to have 70%, 80%, 60% that would say they would support it. You have now about 31% saying they would support it. But all of these elements, which people too often dismiss, they say, who cares what they say who killed Arafat? It does matter. It becomes part of the rhetoric of today. It becomes part of the history tomorrow. The we see the new textbooks that Hamas is putting out. They wrote their own textbooks, and they have whole chapters on cross-border raiding or detailing the attacks against Israelis. It's ridiculous. And you have it, by the way, on the other side. This, three-quarters of Israelis don't believe that negotiations will lead to peace with PA.
On the textbooks, I couldn't even believe the New York Times felt it was newsworthy. But at least they were willing to expose it. I mean, you've been saying this for years,
right,
in terms of what's going on with the education of the of students in the PA areas. So the incitement is always there. Did Netanyahu have a and this is not in direct response to the PA. This was an indirect response the comments about a deal with Iran. The Jerusalem Post says it's the harshest response he's ever had in terms of this negotiation. Now, frankly, Malcolm, for me and other lay people out there, we get so confused. It seems every single week there's a new deal with Iran. And instead of there being some type of systematic, you know, a process towards sanctions or, you know, towards some type of agreement, whatever that agreement is going to be, it seems like every week, all of a sudden, you know, pops up another agreement, another potential, you know, deal with Iran. And this week, it looks like, you know, they're ready to make an agreement where they're literally going to stop, where they're going to agree that sanctions can end if Iran behaves a certain way in terms of nuclear development. Netanyahu responded to all of this in a very harsh way and said that no deal is better than, you know, a bad deal. He has no choice but to respond this way, right?
Well, first of all, it's true. That's the first point. It's not just a response, and it's not just, you know, a rhetorical exercise. This is the most serious issue facing the Middle East, facing Israel, facing America. And the danger is that we fall into the same trap that we did with North Korea in the negotiations with them, that we fell in repeatedly over and over again, and which history shows does not yield the outcome that everybody thinks. Right now, there is a proposal, and you are absolutely right. We're hearing all sorts of suggestions. We don't know the actual text yet of what is being proposed. We've heard the outline, some of it coming from official sources. You know, Iran quintupled the number of advanced centrifuges that it has, so when it says that it'll cut back, and that's just since February, by the way, when it says it cuts back, so the question is, what is it cutting back? Is it stopping all of them? Is it stopping some of them? For what period of time? and the critical conditions, and this is why Netanyahu responded as he did, that anything that leaves intact the infrastructure of enrichment is unacceptable. Because you can go, for instance, the removing of the 20% enriched uranium, but today with the new centrifuges, they don't need 20% enriched uranium as they did in the past as a step on the way to 90%, which is weapons grade. They have to enrich uranium to 90%. So today you can go from 5%. So leaving intact even the 5%, all the infrastructure, all the equipment, all of the plants, if they stay intact and use only the old centrifuges, which are much slower, you have not really changed the fundamentals of the situation. You know, in Iran today, the debate is not whether it should be 5%, 3.5%, 20%. The debate is, do you have to yell death to America? And the answer is yes, and death to Israel. And this is chanted today. We saw the huge demonstrations over the last week. We see the anti-American feeling being incited, being stimulated by the regime, a regime that is no different and worse in many respects than previous regimes, which were Ahmadinejad, which was obvious, and here you have a guy who's much more clever. We run in. Now the European leaders, foreign ministers, are going to join Kerry in Geneva. They're going to make a big...
When is that? That's today, tomorrow?
Today. They're coming. They're on their way there now. And
So the United States is sitting with a country that's chanting and demands their people to chant death to America.
And I'm
for
sorry
a six month
detail,
short...
but I just want to try to put some of this in context before we get into the discussion of where we're going with it. There was no consultation with Congress. Congress does not know more than we know. They read the reports, and I met yesterday with members of Congress. And Congress is a second track that we'll talk about what's happening there in terms of the legislation moving ahead. But Netanyahu says, look, we're not going to be bound by any agreement. This is a bad agreement. And when he says no deal is better than a bad deal, these are the words of Secretary Kerry. And because a bad deal is going to lead to a much more escalated and worse situation in the future than no deal. So what we hear that they're proposing is allowing enrichment at 3.5% to continue, which they say they need for power stations, but they would limit the number of centrifuges being used. But it wouldn't include any demand to remove or disable them, and that Iran would take its 20% uranium and turning it into oxide, which is harmless, but other people say it can be reversed and it can be used, and they can still produce the rest of it in a short period of time. They can produce enough for a bomb. And they're going to allow them to continue to work on the plutonium reactor at Iraq, which is another route to getting a nuclear weapon. They say they won't use the more advanced IR-2 centrifuges and capable of enriching 3 or 5 times faster than the older ones. And the U.S. would ease what they called reversible economic sanctions. The problem is that once you start lifting sanctions, it's very hard to reverse it because the Europeans and others, certainly the Chinese and Russians, the Chinese not abiding by it now, and the Russians abiding by it in the breach, will jump on it because they all want to exploit the money. They all want to get the benefit of Iranian oil, buying oil, and taking advantage of any slippage on this at a time when we should be strengthening it and when the Congress is moving ahead and the House already passed it, the Senate is going to start markup and consideration. I believe it will move ahead despite the administration's urging them not to because they felt it would upset the negotiations. And there are so many points to be made about what the nature of the regime is.
Are all the major foreign ministries of all the European Union at this meeting in Geneva?
They were not, but they were asked to come because perhaps to have the deal signed today, and they want to make it all the more probable by having Laurent Fabius of France and William Hague of Britain, the foreign secretary of Britain, and the German foreign minister Guido Westerwelle were all invited to come and join Kerry in...
It's impossible for the U.S. to not cave in to the EU. The EU wants this deal more than the U.S. does.
No, but it's U.S.-led. It's not the EU-led. They're inviting them to come. But this is a U.S. deal.
Basically, it would give a. Is it what the article says in the Jerusalem Post? That would be a short-term deal where their nuclear activities would stop for 6 months, and there would be, you know, and they would buy time for quote unquote a permanent agreement.
Well, as I said, all the things that I mentioned are stuff that's being speculated in the press. Some of it coming from official sources, but no, they're not stopping them completely. And they're
Iran would freeze its nuclear activities. That report from the press is incorrect.
No, we don't know because we don't know. We haven't seen the deal yet, but there are various reports indicating that it's not really a total freeze,
right,
which Iran would not agree to anyway.
Limited freeze,
and it's not we're not undoing the existing sanctions regime, and the administration keeps saying, and these are reversible regimes. These are other measures. I mean, but what they're proposing, for instance, is unfreezing monies that were frozen in bank accounts around the world, that certain countries could release the funds that they're holding. That's equally dangerous. Once you release the funds, you can't take it back. That's done. So it's not really reversible. We can impose new sanctions. We can tighten the sanctions that exist again. And we're not undoing the fundamentals of the regime. But every concession is a message to the Iranians that you don't have to give up much and you can get a lot.
What I've learned from this conversation is that a week from now, when there'll be a completely different deal out there, and when sanctions and negotiations and freezes are being discussed in some other totally different context, I have a right to be frustrated, because you agree that it seems every single week, and maybe you'd say day by day, the way you follow it, it seems that there's something different going on every single day.
And sometimes hour by hour, and we get different messages from different people, different officials, and some of them, and not because they're lying, because this is what they were told. And as I said, I met with congressional leaders even as recently as yesterday.
And they don't know.
And they themselves don't know exactly what we're dealing with.
On the subject of the media reporting accurately or not, can we trust this report that 22 of the 23 sites in Syria have been dismantled at this point?
These are the disclosed sites. It does not mean that there aren't sites that Syria didn't disclose. It does not mean that they got rid of their stockpiles. It does not mean that there aren't facilities that would be available for them to hide stuff from, let's say, shells with chemical weapons from the inspectors. So the 22 sites which Syria acknowledged have been successfully stopped and some process of dismantlement. Now they have to move to the next stage of really taking them apart, removing hundreds of tons of mustard gas and other chemical weapons that exist in Syria.
Is Jordan going to take the vacated seat by Saudi Arabia on the non-permanent security council, the non-permanent security council seat?
I do not think so. I don't think they're prepared, and I don't think they particularly want it. I do think perhaps ultimately Saudi Arabia may take it because the other options for them are not so palatable about who might get it if they don't. So it's still up in the air. This is, again, directed as a message to the United States. And after this deal, you can imagine it's not just Netanyahu, who is very outspoken about it, but the Saudis, the Jordanians, the Gulf, everybody are going to be very upset by these proposals.
Was this the first week that Egypt announced that they'll be going to elections in 2014, or that's old news already?
Well, they have talked about it in the past, but
it's now official?
This is a new thing. This is a response to a lot of the pressure, the external pressure.
So they have no choice, and they'll elect the entire parliament, right?
Right.
And
supposed to also be a new draft of the Constitution coming out at some point.
So this is a good thing or bad thing to see yet another transition? I know it's not a real transition, but I guess in one way it's Egypt demanding more stability, right? By going to elections.
Well, number one, to satisfy the people internally who are clamoring for a government, responsive government. To the outside pressure, which I think is probably number one, especially the United States, which is demanding a democratic, inclusive government. Right now, Egypt's number one priority is not democracy, it's stability,
right,
and it's how you start to begin to deal with the economy. But frankly, I think as important is their war in Sinai against the terrorist organizations, Al-Qaeda and others, that are operating there, which could destabilize a lot of the region. they have a conflict with Gaza and with Hamas, where they're trying to clamp down on the terrorist activities and the impact on Egypt, and sustaining the Suez Canal safety and security, which is also a source of income, trying to rebuild their tourism industry. Those are the things which the government right now, but they have also still the internal conflict. There are still demonstrations going on by Muslim Brotherhood and supporters. They have moved very strongly against the Muslim Brotherhood leadership, and the Morsi trial was convened for one day and now put off until till January or February. Also, Egypt stopped accepting refugees from Syria because they see it as becoming a destabilizing factor, as will other countries, Jordan, Turkey, others.
Did you hear about the Syrian kid born in Israel?
Yes, but it's another one of those stories that you don't read about when Israel is taking people who are wounded or hurt or can't be treated in Syria. They come to the border, and there is an IDF facility set up, but for cases that require more intense treatment, they are taken to hospitals in Israel and treated. And the first baby born to a Syrian woman was this week.
The baby's an Israeli?
In an Israeli hospital.
The baby's an Israeli citizen or not?
I don't think.
I keep saying yes.
Only you would think of that.
I'm going with the logical choice. Then, yeah, why not, obviously. American drones Friday killed the leader of the Pakistani Taliban, dealing a major blow to a militant group that has terrorized Pakistan that tried to set off a car bomb in New York City in 2010. Any diplomatic repercussions for the U.S. as they continue these drone attacks and take out some more and more bad guys?
Sure. There are a lot of domestic ramifications in Pakistan, which is a frenemy, as they called it.
Right.
They call it, a friend and enemy,
mm-hmm.
Depending upon what hour of the day it is. And the growth, Al-Qaeda was born in Pakistan, not in Afghanistan.
Right.
And you have strong Islamist elements. It's a powerful country. These attacks then become the government officials attack the United States for them. In some cases, they wanted to be given shared credit, like when they took out the Al-Qaeda leadership, when Osama bin Laden was killed. So some people were resentful that they didn't get enough credit, and others say, don't give us any credit. We don't want to be, and then they can criticize the United States for it. But there is this debate inside Pakistan about the violation of their sovereignty when the United States carries out these drone attacks, which are called for, valid. I think under international law, you can take steps to prevent an attack, and that, and eliminating an Al-Qaeda leader like that does that.
Finally, about the foreign minister of Israel, or the former foreign minister of Israel, Avigdor Lieberman, being found by the court as acquitted by the court, but told by the court that his behavior was not ethical. Strange reaction by the court, right? That he's acquitted, but told how some of his behavior was unethical. Anyway, your reaction to all this, he will likely be foreign minister again, right?
Within a few days. I think it's going to be a shock to the political system. I think there were people who were counting not on his full conviction, but a partial conviction that might keep him out of politics for this till the next government, or for this round, or maybe longer. You remember, he was under investigation for, I think, 17 years.
Yeah, I thought 13, but yeah, something
and,
like that.
Well, this is the total of, right, of the investigations, not just charges, but this is a boucha. This is such an embarrassment again to the judicial system, not the judges, but to the investigators, to the police, to these charges that are constantly being brought, and they, most cases lately, have amounted to non convictions. The real test now that comes up is Olmert, whose court case and the outcome will be determined within a couple weeks.
But in Lieberman's case, Malcolm, in all fairness, as the years went by, didn't evidence, witnesses, testimony start to disappear?
No.
I mean, you call it a boucha, but the reality is they had a lot less to deal with now than they would have years ago.
Yes, but the outcome is what you measure. And I will tell you one thing, that he can run as Mr. Clean because there's nobody who's been investigated more. There's no single charge you could bring against him anymore, because I'm sure everything that he's ever done has been examined now. And And it will be a shock. It will be a challenge to Netanyahu. He's I assure you, meeting already with some of the other parties, like Bennett. I think he could challenge the prime minister in the future for his position. But he certainly will come and bring his own mark again to the foreign ministry. And it doesn't go all one way. People think he's an extreme hardliner. He is on certain issues, and he's not on others. He also has a base. And the question is, can he sustain that base? How will the Israeli voters react to his return? And will his party split from Likud this time? Will they build a local bases, like running for mayors, et cetera, which they did? There are a lot of question marks.
So Netanyahu calls it the Iran deal a mistake of historical proportions. Will that mistake be made in the next couple of days or not? Your prediction?
It's well on its way to being made. I think that there'll be a lot of regret. You can see the already the seeds and blossoming of nuclear powers emerging, including the Saudis maybe first, but many others after them. I think it's going to involve a loss of trust, further loss of trust in the United States and in the West. I think the people in Israel are going to be very wary of this deal, and you're going to see many more harsh comments. We're going to see what the leaders of Congress have to say. You know, the American people obviously want to see this thing resolved. Nobody wants a war, but this kind of weakness is exactly what leads countries like Iran and its long history, and especially Rouhani, the current leader's history, is exactly that. He takes advantage of it. He wrote books about how he took advantage of it. He gives public speeches about how he took advantage of it. And you can be sure that's what they're going to do now.
Hey, Malcolm, let's do it again next week, huh?
I think you'll be won't have a problem finding material.
That's for sure. It all starts about now, frankly. That's when the material begins. Have a wonderful Shabbos. Malcolm Hohnlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.